cave of goods that would glut the 40 thieves.
Ali Baba, Uncle Martim, so many things. I'm not crossing Africa, I'm only going to the high mountains of Portugal some few days away.
You're going farther than you think, his uncle replies. You'll be venturing into lands that have never seen an automobile. You'll need the capacity to be autonomous, which is why I've included a good canvas rain tarp and some blankets, although you might be better off sleeping in the cabin. That box there contains all the motoring tools you'll need. Next to it is the oiling can. This 5-gallon metal barrel is full of water for the radiator, and this one of motonaphtha, the automobile's elixir of life. Resupply yourself as often as you can, because at some point you'll have to rely on your own stock. Along the way, look out for apothecaries, bicycle shops, blacksmiths, ironmongers. They'll have motonaphtha, though they may give it another name, petroleum spirit, mineral spirit, something like that. Smell it before you buy it. I've also provided you with victuals. An automobile is best operated by a well-fed driver. Now, see if these fit.
From a bag on the floor of the cabin, his uncle pulls out a pair of pale leather gloves. Tomas tries them on, baffled. The fit is snug. The leather is pleasingly elastic and creaks when he makes a fist.
Thank you, he says uncertainly.
Take good care of them. They're from France, too.
Next, his uncle hands him goggles that are big and hideous. Tomas has hardly put them on when his uncle brings out a beige coat lined with fur that reaches well below his knees.
Waxed cotton and mink, the finest quality, he says.
Tomas puts it on. The coat is heavy and bulky. Finally, Lobo slaps a hat on him that has straps that tie under the chin. Gloved, goggled, coated and hatted, he feels like a giant mushroom.
Uncle, what is this costume for?
For motoring, of course. For the wind and the dust, for the rain and the cold. It is December. Have you not noticed the driving compartment?
He looks. His uncle has a point. The back part of the automobile consists of the enclosed cubicle for the passengers. The driving compartment in front of it, however, is open to the elements but for the roof and a front window. There are no doors or windows on either side. Wind, dust, and rain will easily come in. He grouses internally. If his uncle hadn't cluttered the cabin with so much gear, making it impossible for him to sit within, he could take shelter there while Sabio drove the machine. His uncle presses on.
I've included maps as good as they exist. When they are of no help, rely on the compass. You're heading north-northeast. The roads of Portugal are of the poorest quality, but the vehicle has a fine suspension system, leaf springs. They will handle any ruts. If the roads get to you, drink plenty of wine. There are 2 wineskins in the cabin. Avoid roadside inns and stagecoaches. They are not your friends. It's understandable. A degree of hostility is to be expected from those whose livelihood the automobile directly threatens. Right. As for the rest of the supplies, you'll figure out what's what. We should get going. Sabio, are you ready?
Yes, senor,
replies Sabio with military promptness.
Let me get my jacket. I'll drive you to the edges of Lisbon, Tomas.
His uncle returns to the house. Tomas doffs the ludicrous motoring costume and returns it to the cabin. His uncle bounces back into the courtyard, a jacket on his back, gloves upon his hands, his cheeks flushed with excitement, exuding a nearly terrifying joviality.
By the way, Tomas, he bellows, I forgot to ask, why on earth do you so badly want to go to the high mountains of Portugal?
I'm looking for something, Tomas replies.
What?
Tomas hesitates.
It's in a church, he finally says, only I'm not sure which one, in which village.
His uncle stands next to him and studies him. Tomas wonders whether he should say more. Whenever his uncle comes to the Museum of Ancient Art, he gazes at the exhibits with glazed eyes. "Have you heard of Charles Darwin, uncle?" Tomas asks.
"Yes, I've heard of Darwin," Lobo replies. "What, is he buried in a church in the high mountains of Portugal?"
He laughs.
"You want to bring his body back and give it pride of place in the Museum of Ancient Art?"
"No. Through my work, I came upon a diary written on Sao Tome in the Gulf of Guinea. The island has been a Portuguese colony since the late 15th century."
"A miserable one. I stopped there once on my way to Angola. I thought I might invest in some cocoa plantations there."
"It was an important place during the slave trade."
"Well, now it's a producer of bad chocolate. Beautiful plantations, though."
"No doubt. By a process of deduction involving three disparate elements, the diary I've just mentioned, the log book of a ship returning to Lisbon, and a fire in a village church in the high mountains of Portugal, I have discovered an unsuspected treasure and located it approximately. I'm on the brink of a great find."
"Are you? And what is this treasure exactly?"
his uncle asks, his eyes steady on Tomas. Tomas is sorely tempted. All these months he has told no one, especially not his colleagues, about his discovery, nor even about his research. He did it all on his own time, privately. But a secret yearns to be divulged, and in mere days the object will be found. So why not his uncle?
"It is a religious statuary, a crucifix, I believe," he replies.
"Just what this Catholic country needs."
"No, you don't understand. It's a very odd crucifix, a wondrous crucifix."
"Is it? And what does it have to do with Darwin?"
"You'll see," Tomas replies, flushing with zeal. "This Christ on the cross has something important to say. Of that I am certain."
His uncle waits for more, but more does not come.
"Well, I hope it makes your fortune. Off we go," he says.
He climbs into the driver's seat.
"Let me show you how to start the engine."
He claps his hands and roars,
"Sabio!"
Sabio steps forward, his gaze fixed on the automobile, his hands at the ready.
"Before starting the engine, the moto naphtha tap has to be turned to open. Good man, Sabio. The throttle handle, here under the steerage wheel, has to be placed at half admission, so, and the change speed lever set at the neutral point, like this. Next, you flick the magneto switch, here on the dashboard, to on. Then you open the lid of the hood. There's no need to open the whole hood. You see that small lid there at the front? And you press down once or twice on the float of the carburetor to flood it. See how Sabio does it? You close the lid, and all that's left after that is turning the starting handle. Then you sit in the driver's seat, take the handbrake off, get into first gear, and away you go. It's child's play. Sabio, are you ready?"
Sabio faces the engine squarely and sets his legs apart, feet solidly planted on the ground. He bends down and grips the starting handle, a thin rod protruding from the front of the automobile. His arms straight, his back straight. He suddenly snaps the handle upward with great force, pulling himself upright. Then, upon the handle completing a half-turn, he shoves down on it, using the full weight of his body before working the upswing as he did the first time. He performs this circular action with enormous energy, with the result that not only does the whole automobile shake, but the handle spins round two, maybe three times. Tomas is about to comment on Sabio's prowess, but for the result attending this spinning of the handle. The automobile roars to life. It starts with a sputtering rumble from deep within its bowels, followed by a succession of piercing explosions. As it begins to judder and shudder, his uncle yells,
"Come on, hop aboard! Let me show you what this remarkable invention can do!"
Tomas unwillingly but speedily clambers up to sit next to his uncle on the padded seat that stretches across the driving compartment. His uncle does a maneuver with his hands and feet, pulling this and pressing that. Tomas sees Sabio straddling a motorcycle that is standing next to a wall, then kick-starting it. He will be a good man to have along. Then, with a jerk, the machine moves. Quickly, it gathers speed and swerves out of the courtyard, throwing itself over the threshold of the opened gates of the Lobo estate onto Rua do Pau de Bandeira, where it does a sharp right turn. Tomas slides across the smooth leather of the seat and slams into his uncle. He cannot believe the bone-jarring, mind-unhinging quaking he is experiencing, directly related to the noise-making, because such trembling can come only from such noise. The machine will surely shake itself to pieces. He realizes he has misunderstood the point of the suspension springs his uncle mentioned. Clearly their purpose is not to protect the automobile from ruts, but ruts from the automobile. Even more upsetting is the extremely fast and independent forward motion of the device. He sticks his head out the side and casts a look backwards, thinking, hoping, that he will see the Lobo household, every family member and employee, pushing the machine and laughing at the joke they are pulling on him. Would that Dora were among those pushers. But there are no pushers. It seems unreal to him that no animal should be pulling or pushing the device. It's an effect without a cause, and therefore disturbingly unnatural. Oh, the alpine summits of Lapa! The automobile coughing, sputtering, rattling, clattering, jouncing, bouncing, chuffing, puffing, whining, roaring, dashes down to the end of Rua do Pau de Bandeira, the cobblestones underfoot making their presence known with a ceaseless, explosive rat-a-tat, then violently lurches leftwards and falls off the street as if from a cliff, such as the steepness of Rua do Prior. Tomas's guts feel as if they are being squeezed into a funnel. The automobile reaches the bottom of the street with a flattening that sends him crashing to the floor of the driving compartment. The machine has barely stabilized itself, and he regained his seat, if not his composure, before it springs up the last upward part of Rua do Prior onto Rua da Santa Trindade, which in turn descends steeply. The automobile gaily starts to dance over the metallic jaws of Santa Trindade's tram tracks, sending him sliding to and fro across the seat, alternately smashing into his uncle, who does not seem to notice, or practically falling out of the automobile at the other end of the seat. From balconies that fleet by, he sees people scowling down at them. His uncle takes the right turn at Rua de São João da Mata with ferocious conviction. Down the street they race. Tomas is blinded by the sun. His uncle seems unaffected. The automobile pounces across Rua de Santos Ovelho and bolts down the curve of Calçada Ribeiro Santos. Upon reaching the Largo de Santos, he looks wistfully and briefly at the walkers indulging in the slow activities of its pleasant park. His uncle drives around it until, with a savage left turn, he flings the automobile onto the wide Avenida 20 y 4 de Julio. Lapa's lapping waters, the breathtaking Tagus, open up to the right in a burst of light, but Tomas does not have time to appreciate the sight as they hurtle through the urban density of Lisbon in a blur of wind and noise. They spin so fast around the busy roundabout of Praça do Duque de Terceira that the vehicle is projected slingshot-like down Rua do Arsenal. The hurly-burly of the Praça do Comercio is no impediment, merely an amusing challenge. Indistinctly, Tomás sees the statue of the Marquis of Pombal standing in the middle of the square. Oh! If only the Marquis knew what horrors his streets were being subjected to, he might not have rebuilt them. On they go, onward and forward, in a roar of rush, in a smear of color. Throughout, traffic of every kind, horses, carts, carriages, drays, trams, hordes of people and dogs, bumble around them blindly. Tomas expects a collision at any moment with an animal or a human, but his uncle saves them at the last second from every certain death encounter with a sudden swerve or a harsh stoppage. A number of times Tomas feels the urge to scream, but his face is too stiff with fright. Instead, he presses his feet against the floorboards with all his might. If he thought his uncle would accept being treated like a life buoy, he would gladly hold on to him. All along, his uncle, when he is not hurling insults at strangers, is lit up with joy, his red face radiating excitement, his mouth creased up in a smile, his eyes shining, and he laughs with insane abandon or shouts a one-way conversation of acclamations and exclamations.
Amazing! Glorious! Fantastic! Didn't I tell you? Now that's how you take a left turn! Extraordinary! Absolutely extraordinary! Look, look, we must be hitting 50 kilometers an hour!
Meanwhile, the Tagus flows, placid, unhurried, unperturbed, a gentle behemoth next to the outrageous flea that leaps along its bank. Next to a field upon a fledgling rural road without any cobblestone finery, his uncle at last stops the automobile. Behind them, at some distance, Lisbon's skyline stands like the emerging teeth of a small child.
"See how far we've come, and so fast!"
his uncle's voice booms in the refreshing silence. He is beaming like a boy on his birthday. Tomas looks at him for a few seconds, incapable of speech, then practically falls to the ground, getting out of the driving compartment. He staggers to a nearby tree and supports himself against it. He bends forward and a heaving gush of vomit spews from his mouth. His uncle shows understanding.
"Motion sickness,"
he diagnoses breezily as he removes his driving gloves.
"It's a curious thing. Some passengers are subject to it, but never the driver. Must be something to do with controlling the vehicle, perhaps being able to anticipate the coming bumps and turns. That, or the mental effort of driving, distracts the stomach from any malaise it might feel. You'll be fine once you're behind the wheel."
It takes a moment for Tomas to register the words. He cannot imagine holding the reins of this metallic stallion. "Sabio is coming with me, isn't he?" he asks breathlessly as he wipes the sides of his mouth with his handkerchief.
"I'm not lending you Sabio, who will look after my other vehicles. Besides, he's made sure the Renault is in tip-top running order. You won't need him."
"But Sabio will drive the thing, Uncle."
"Drive it? Why would you want that? Why would anyone want to delegate to a servant the thrill of driving such an astonishing invention? Sabio is here to work, not to play."
Just then, the servant in question appears, expertly directing the sputtering motorcycle off the road to stop it behind the automobile. Tomas turns to his uncle again. It's his blistering ill fortune to have a relative with the wealth to own several automobiles and the eccentricity to want to drive them himself.
"Sabio drives you around, dear uncle?"
"Only on formal occasions. It's mostly Gabriella he carts about. Silly mouse doesn't dare try it herself. You're young and smart. You'll do fine. Won't he, Sabio?"
Sabio, who is standing quietly next to them, nods in agreement. But the way his eyes linger on Tomas makes Tomas feel that he does not fully share his employer's sunny trust. Anxiety roils his stomach.
"Uncle Martin, please, I have no experience in—"
"Look here. You start in neutral with the throttle at half. To get going, you put yourself in first gear, then release the clutch slowly as you press on the accelerator pedal. As you gather speed, you move up to second gear, then third. It's easy. Just start on flat ground. You'll get the knack in no time."
His uncle steps back and fondly contemplates the automobile. Tomas hopes that during this pause, kindness and solicitude will soften his uncle's heart. Instead, he delivers a last blast of peroration.
Tomas, I hope you are aware that what you have before your eyes is a highly trained orchestra, and it plays the most lovely symphony. The pitch of the piece is pleasingly variable, the timbre dark but brilliant, the melody simple yet soaring. And the tempo lies between vivace and presto, although it does a fine adagio. When I am the conductor of this orchestra, what I hear is a glorious music, the music of the future. Now you are stepping up to the podium, and I am passing you the baton. You must rise to the occasion.
He pats the driver's seat in the automobile.
You sit here, he says.
Tomas's lungs are suddenly gasping for air. His uncle gestures to Sabio to start the engine. Once again, the roar of the internal combustion engine fills the exterior countryside. He has no choice. He has waited too long, understood too late. He will have to get behind the steerage wheel of the monster. He climbs aboard. His uncle again points, explains, nods, smiles.
You'll be all right, he concludes. Things will work out. I'll see you when you return, Tomas. Good luck. Sabio, stay and help him out.
With the finality of a door slamming, his uncle turns and disappears behind the automobile. Tomas cranes his head out the side to find him. Uncle Martim, he shouts. The motorcycle starts with a detonation, followed by a grinding sound as it moves off. His last view of his uncle is the sight of his ample girth overhanging both sides of the slender machine, and his disappearance down the road in a thunder of mechanical flatulence. Tomas turns his eyes to Sabio. It occurs to him that his uncle has departed on the motorcycle, and that he is to leave with the automobile. How then will Sabio return from the outer northeast edge of Lisbon to his employer's house in western Lapa? Sabio speaks quietly.
Driving the automobile is possible, senor. It only needs a little practice.
Of which I have none, Tomas cries. Neither practice nor knowledge, neither interest nor aptitude. Save my life and show me again how to use this blasted thing.
Sabio goes over the daunting details of piloting the manufactured animal. He instructs with untiring patience, spending much time over the proper order in which to press or release the pedals and pull or push the levers. He reminds Tomas about the left and right turning of the steerage wheel. He teaches him the use of the throttle handle, which is needed not only to start the engine, but to stop it. And he speaks on matters Uncle Martim said nothing about, the difference between pressing hard or lightly on the accelerator pedal, the usage of the brake pedal, the important handbrake which he is to pull whenever the automobile is at rest, the use of the side mirrors. Sabio shows him how to turn the starting handle. When Tomas tries it, he feels something heavy turning inside the automobile, like a boar on a spit being rotated in a vat of thick sauce. On his third turn of the spit, the boar explodes. He stalls the engine again and again. Each time, Sabio gamely returns to the front of the machine, where he gets it to roar to life again. Then he proposes to put the machine into first gear. Tomas slides over to the passenger side of the driving compartment. Sabio does the necessary maneuvers. The gears sigh consent, and the machine inches forward. Sabio points to where he should put his hands and where he should press his foot. Tomas moves into place. Sabio works his way out of the driver's seat onto the footboard, nods gravely at him, and steps off the automobile. Tomas feels cast off, thrown away, abandoned. The road ahead is straight, and the machine grunts along noisily in first gear. The steerage wheel is a hard, unfriendly thing. It shakes in his hands. He tugs it one way. Is it left? Is it right? He can't tell. He's barely able to make it move. How did his uncle do it so easily? And keeping the accelerator pedal pressed down is exceedingly tiresome. His foot is starting to cramp. At the first bend, a slight curve to the right, as the automobile starts to cross over the road and head towards a ditch, alarm pushes him to action, and he lifts his foot and stamps on one pedal after another at random. The machine coughs and jolts to a halt. The clanging pandemonium mercifully stops. Tomas looks about. His uncle is gone. Sabio is gone. There is no one else in sight. And his beloved Lisbon is gone, too, scraped away like the leftovers of a meal off a plate. Into a silence that is more vacuum than repose, his little son vaults into his mind. Gaspar often ventured out to play in the courtyard of his uncle's house before being shooed away by one servant or another like a stray cat. He also prowled about the garage, filled as it was with rows of bicycles and motorcycles and automobiles. His uncle would have found a kindred spirit in his son when it came to motoring. Gaspar stared at the automobiles like a hungry mouth eats. Then he died, and the courtyard now contains a silent parcel of emptiness. Other parts of his uncle's house similarly afflict Tomas with the absence of Dora or of his father, this door, that chair, this window. What are we without the ones we love? Would he ever get over the loss? When he looks in his eyes in the mirror, when he shaves, he sees empty rooms. And the way he goes about his days, he is a ghost who haunts his own life. Weeping is nothing new to him. He has wept many, many times since death dealt him a triple blow. A remembrance of Dora, Gaspar, or his father is often both the source and the focus of his grief, but there are times when he bursts into tears for no reason that he can discern, an occurrence as random as a sneeze. The situation now is clearly very different in nature. How can a noisy, uncontrollable machine and three coffins be compared in their effect? But strangely, he feels upset in the same way, filled with that same acute sense of dread, aching loneliness, and helplessness. So he weeps and he pants, grief in competition with simmering panic. He pulls out the diary from his jacket pocket and presses it to his face. He smells its great age. He closes his eyes. He takes refuge in Africa, in the waters off its western equatorial coast, on the Portuguese island colony of São Tomé. His grief seeks the man who is leading him to the high mountains of Portugal. He tried to find information on Father Ulysses Manuel Rosario Pinto, but history seemed to have forgotten him nearly entirely. There was no trace of him but for two dates that gave his unfinished outlines. His birth on July 14, 1603, as attested by the São Tiago Parish Registry in Coimbra, and his ordination as a priest in that same city in the Cathedral of the Holy Cross on May 1, 1629. No other detail of his life, down to the date of his death, could Tomás find. All that remained of Father Ulysses in the river of time, pushed far downstream, was this floating leaf of a diary. He pulls the diary away from his face. His tears have marred its cover. This does not please him. He is professionally annoyed. He dabs at the cover with his shirt. How strange, this habit of weeping. Do animals weep? Surely they feel sadness, but do they express it with tears? He doubts it. He has never heard of a weeping cat or dog, or of a weeping wild animal. It seems to be a uniquely human trait. He doesn't see what purpose it serves. He weeps hard, even violently, and at the end of it, what? Desolate tiredness, a handkerchief soaked in tears and mucus, red eyes for everyone to notice. And weeping is undignified. It lies beyond the tutorials of etiquette, and remains a personal idiom, individual in its expression. The twist of face, quantity of tears, quality of sob, pitch of voice, volume of clamor, effect on the complexion, the play of hands, the posture taken. One discovers weeping, one's weeping personality, only upon weeping. It is a strange discovery, not only to others, but to oneself.
Resolve surges in him. There is a church in the high mountains of Portugal waiting for him. He must get to it. This metal box on wheels will help him do that, and so sitting behind its controls is where he should be.
Isso é minha casa. This is home.
He looks down at the pedals. He looks at the levers. It is a good hour before he heads off. The problem does not lie in starting the automobile. That, after seeing Sabio do it so many times, is manageable. Arms straight, back straight, legs doing the work, he turns the starting handle. The warm engine seems disposed to starting again. The problem lies in getting the machine moving. Whatever permutation of pedals and levers he uses, the end result is always the same, a grinding squeal or an angry barking, often quite violent, with no movement forward. He takes breaks. He sits in the driving compartment. He stands next to the automobile. He goes for short walks. Sitting on the footboard, he eats bread, ham, cheese, dried figs, and he drinks wine. It is a joyless meal. The automobile is always on his mind. It stands there, looking incongruous on the side of the road. The horse and ox traffic going by notice it, and notice him. But so close to Lisbon, either coming or going, the drivers hurry their animals on, only shouting or waving a greeting. He does not have to explain himself. At last it happens. After countless fruitless efforts, he presses on the accelerator pedal, and the machine advances. He mightily wrenches the steerage wheel in the direction he hopes is the correct one. It is. The vehicle is now in the center of the road and moving ahead. To avoid the ditch on either side, he has to hold his ship to a single fixed course, the narrow, shrunken horizon dead ahead. Maintaining a straight line towards that bottomless dot is exhausting. The machine constantly wants to veer off course, and there are bumps and holes in the road. There are people, too, who stare harder the farther he gets from Lisbon. Worse, though, are the large drays and carts, heavily laden with goods and produce for the city. They appear ahead of him, plugging the horizon. As they get closer, they seem to take up an increasing share of the road. They clip-clop slowly, confidently, stupidly, while he races towards them. He has to calculate his course exactly so that he drives next to them and not into them. His eyes tire from the strain, and his hands hurt from gripping the steerage wheel. Suddenly he has had enough. He presses on a pedal. The automobile coughs to a harsh stop, throwing him against the steerage wheel. He steps down, exhausted but relieved. He blinks in astonishment. The application of the brake pedal has unpacked the landscape, and it billows out around him, trees, hills, and vineyards to his left, textured fields, and the Tagus to his right. He saw none of these while he was driving. There was only the devouring road ahead. What luck to live in a land that so unceasingly agrees to be agreeable. No wonder wine is made here. The road is now empty, and he is alone. In the dying light of the day, wispy and opal, he is soothed by the quiet of an early evening in the country. He remembers lines from Father Ulysses' diary, which he recites under his breath. I come not to shepherd the free, but the unfree. The first have their own church. My flock's church has no walls and a ceiling that reaches up to the Lord. With his lungs and with his eyes, Tomas takes in the open church around him, the soft, fecund appeal of Portugal. He doesn't know how far he has traveled, but surely more than he would have on foot. Enough for a first day. Tomorrow he will apply himself further. Constructing a shelter from a rain tarp seems a great bother. He chooses instead to make a bedroom of the enclosed back cabin, as his uncle suggested, which leads him to inspect his uncle's contribution to the expedition. He finds lightweight pots and pans, a small burner that works on white cubes of dried spirit, a bowl, a plate, a cup, utensils, all of metal, soup powder, rolls and loaves of bread, dried meats and fish, sausages, fresh vegetables, fresh and dried fruit, olives, cheese, milk powder, cocoa powder, coffee, honey, cookies and biscuits, a bottle of cooking oil, spices and condiments, a large jug of water, the motoring coat with its attending items, the gloves, the hat, the hideous goggles, 6 automobile tires, rope, an axe, a sharp knife, matches and candles, a compass, a blank notebook, lead pencils, a set of maps, a French-Portuguese dictionary, the Renault manual, wool blankets, the box of tools and other motoring necessities, the barrel of motonaptha, the canvas rain tarp with lanyards and pegs, and more.
So many things!
His uncle's excessive solicitude means that he has difficulty making space for himself in the cabin. When he has cleared the sofa, he tries lying down on it. It's not very long. To sleep on it, he would have to lie with his knees tucked in. He peers through the wide front window of the cabin into the driving compartment. The seat there is a tad firm, but flat and level, more like a bench, and because it's not boxed in at either end by a door, he will be able to stretch his feet out. He picks out bread, dried cod, olives, a wineskin, his uncle's coat, as well as the automobile manual and the dictionary, and transfers back to the driving compartment. He lies on his back on the seat, feet sticking out of the compartment. Doing as he was told by his uncle, he settles down to some motoring study, his hands holding the automobile manual, the dictionary lying on his chest. It turns out that lubrication is a serious affair. With dawning horror, he realizes that the gears, the clutch cup, the back axle, the front and back joints of the transmission shaft, the bearings of all the wheels, the joints of the front axle, the spindle axle bearings, the connecting axles, the joints of the driving rod, the magneto shaft, the hinges of the doors, and, the list goes on, essentially everything that moves in the machine needs obsessive lubrication. Many of these need a little squirt every morning before the engine is started. Some need it every 2 to 3 days, others once a week, while with still others it's a question of mileage. He sees the automobile in a different light. It is 100 little chicks chirping frantically, their necks extended and their beaks opened wide, their whole beings trembling with need as they scream for their drops of oil. How will he keep track of all these begging mouths? How much simpler were the instructions for Father Ulysses' gift? These turned out to be no more than a plea that good Portuguese craftsmen back home, blessed with access to the highest quality paint, should do a proper job of repainting his masterwork. In the meantime, he had to do with poor local substitutes. As the night freshens, Tomás is thankful for his uncle's coat. The mink is warm and soft. He falls asleep imagining that the coat is Dora. She too was warm and soft, and gentle and graceful, and beautiful and caring. But the ministrations of Dora are overcome by worry. All those begging mouths! And he sleeps poorly. The next morning, after breakfast, he finds the oiling can and he follows the manual's directives line by line, illustration by illustration, paragraph after paragraph, page after page. He lubricates the entire automobile, which involves not only lifting the hood up on its hinges and sticking his head in the machine's entrails, but removing the floor of the driving compartment to access parts of its anatomy there, and even crawling on the ground and sliding under the machine. It is a tiresome, finicky, dirty business. Then he gives it water. After that, he has to confront a pressing problem. The machine, which his uncle claimed was at the acme of technological perfection, fails to provide one of the more basic feats of technology, plumbing. He has to use the leaves of a nearby shrub. The starting up of the cold engine is long and painful. If only his limbs were stronger. Then there is the maddening conundrum of getting the machine to giddy up once it is huffing and rattling. From the moment of waking to the moment when the machine fortuitously jerks forward, 4 hours pass. He grips the wheel and focuses on the road. He approaches Pova de Santa Iria, a small town near Lisbon, the closest settlement to the northeast of the capital on this road, a place that until then has lain dormant in the atlas of his mind. His heart beats like a drum as he enters the town. Men appear with napkins hanging from their shirt fronts, a chicken leg or other repast in their hands, and stare. Barbers holding foaming brushes, followed by men with shaving foam lathered on their faces, run out and stare. A group of old women make the sign of the cross and stare. Men stop their talking and stare. Women stop their shopping and stare. An old man makes a military salute and stares. 2 women laugh in fright and stare. A bench of old men chew their toothless jaws and stare. Children shriek, run to hide, and stare. A horse neighs and makes to buck, startling its driver, and stares. Sheep in a pen off the main street bleat in despair and stare. Cattle low and stare. A donkey brays and stares. Dogs bark and stare. In the midst of this excruciating visual autopsy, Tomas fails to press hard enough on the accelerator pedal. The machine coughs once, twice, then dies. He jabs at the pedal. Nothing happens. He closes his eyes to contain his frustration. After a moment, he opens them and looks around. In front of him, to the sides of him, behind him, 1,000 eyeballs, human and animal, are staring at him. Not a sound is to be heard. The eyeballs blink, and the silence crumbles. Imperceptibly, shyly, the people of Pova de Santa Iria ooze forward, pressing the automobile on all sides until they are 10, 15 thick. Some are wreathed in smiles and pepper him with questions. Who are you? Why have you stopped? How does it work? What does it cost? Are you rich? Are you married? A few glare and grumble. Have you no pity for our ears? Why do you throw so much dust in our faces? Children shout silly questions. What's its name? What does it eat? Is the horse in the cabin? What does his caca look like? Many people come forward to stroke the machine. Most simply stare in benign silence. The man of the military salute salutes every time Tomas happens to look his way. In the background, the sheep, horses, donkeys, and dogs start up again with their respective noises. After an hour of idle talk with the townspeople, it becomes clear to Tomas that they will not go away until he has left their town. He has somewhere to go. They don't. He must, at this moment, overcome his natural reticence. In a morass of self-consciousness, digging deep into his inner reserves, he climbs out of the driving compartment, stands on the footboard, and asks the people to move away from the front of the machine. The people do not seem to hear or understand. He exhorts them, but they only creep forward again and again in ever greater numbers. There develops such a crush of people around the automobile that he has to squeeze himself between bodies to get to the starting handle, and he has to push them back to make space to turn it. Some gawkers stand on the footboards.
Others even make to clamber into the driving compartment, though a stony glare dissuades them. Children, grins plastered upon their faces, keep squeezing the horn's rubber bulb with demented glee. Fatefully, after several trips to the starting handle and yet another bout of plying pedals and levers, the vehicle leaps forward, then promptly dies. Cries erupt all round as the people in front of the machine shriek and clutch their chests in fright. Women scream, children wail, men mutter. The military man stops saluting. Tomas shouts apologies, strikes the steerage wheel, reprimands the automobile in the strongest terms. He jumps out to help the affronted people. He kicks the vehicle's tires. He slaps its elephant-ear mudguards. He insults its ugly hood. He fiercely turns the starting handle, putting the machine in its place. All to no positive effect. The goodwill of the people of Pova de Santa Iria has evaporated in the wintry Portuguese sun. He hurries back to the driving compartment. Miraculously, the automobile whines, shakes itself, and tiptoes ahead. The people of Pova de Santa Iria part fearfully before him, and the road opens up. He urges the machine on. He determinedly roars through the next town, Alverca do Ribatejo, keeping his foot firmly on the accelerator pedal. He ignores all the people and their stares. It is the same with the town of Alhandra. Past Alhandra, he sees a sign saying Porto Alto, pointing to the right, off the main road, to the Tagus. Three bridges span two small islands. He peers across to the flat, desolate countryside beyond the river's eastern shore and brings the automobile to a halt. He turns the engine off and fetches the maps of Portugal from the cabin. There are a number of these, neatly folded and labeled, a national map and the regional ones of Estremadura, Ribatejo, Alto Alentejo, Beira Baixa, Beira Alta, Douro Litoral, and Alto Douro. There are even maps of the neighboring Spanish provinces of Cáceres, Salamanca, and Zamora. It seems his uncle has prepared him for every conceivable route to the high mountains of Portugal, including the wayward and lost. He examines the national map, exactly as he thought. To the west and north of the Tagus, along or near Portugal's litoral, the land is crowded with towns and cities. By comparison, the back country beyond the river, to the east of the Tagus and in the lands bordering Spain, reassures him with the sparseness of its settlements. Only Castelo Branco, Covilha, and Guarda glare with urban danger. Perhaps he can find ways to avoid them. Otherwise, what motorist would be afraid of settlements such as Rosmaninal, Memoa, or Zava? He has never heard of these obscure villages. He starts the automobile and plies different pedals and pushes the change speed lever into first gear. Fortune favors him. He turns to the right and works his way down the road to the bridges. On the cusp of the first bridge, he hesitates. It is a wooden bridge. He remembers about the 30 horses. But surely the engine does not weigh 30 horses. He is mindful of Father Ulisse's experience on water, sailing from Angola to his new mission on São Tomé. Traveling over water is a form of hell, all the more so in a cramped and fetid slave ship holding 552 slaves and their 36 European keepers. We are plagued by periods of dead calm, then rough seas. The slaves moan and cry at all hours of the day and night. The hot stench of their quarters seeps through the whole ship. Tomas presses on. He is not bedeviled by slaves, only ghosts. And his ship must only make three jumps over a river. The crossing of the bridges is a rumbling affair. He fears that he will drive the machine off them. When he has escaped the third bridge and reached the eastern shore of the river, he is too rattled to drive on.
He decides that since he is motoring, perhaps he should properly learn how to motor. He stops and retrieves what he needs from the cabin. Sitting behind the steerage wheel, manual and dictionary at hand, he applies himself to learning the proper operation of the change speed lever, the clutch pedal, and the accelerator pedal. The manual is illuminating, but the knowledge he gains from it is purely theoretical. Its application is the rub. He finds moving smoothly from neutral gear, as his uncle called it, though he finds nothing neutral about it, to first gear, insuperably difficult. Over the course of the rest of the day, in jarring fits and starts, he advances perhaps 500 meters, the machine roaring and coughing and shuddering and stopping the whole way. He curses until nightfall sends him to bed. In the dimming light, as fingers of cold reach for him, he seeks calm in Father Ulysses' diary. If the empire be a man, then the hand that is holding up a solid gold bullion is Angola, while the other that is jingling pennies in the pocket, that is Sao Tome. So the priest quotes an aggrieved trader. Tomás has studied the history that Father Ulysses is fated to live. The priest set foot on Sao Tome between sugar and chocolate, between the island's time as a leading exporter of sugar in the late 16th century, and of the chocolate bean now in the early 20th century. He would live the rest of his short life at the start of a three-century-long trough of poverty, stagnation, despair, and decadence, a time when Sao Tome was an island of half-abandoned plantations and feuding elites who made the better part of their meager living off the living, that is, from the slave trade. The island supplied slave ships with provisions, water, wood, yams, maize flour, fruit, and exploited some slaves for its own needs. The ongoing marginal production of sugar, cotton, rice, ginger, and palm oil, but the white islanders mainly acted as slave brokers. They could not dream of rivaling Angola's vast and endless domestic supply, but the Bight of Benin was at their doorstep across the Gulf of Guinea, and that coast was rich with slaves. The island was both an ideal way station for a ship about to cross the Atlantic, the hellish voyage that came to be called the Middle Passage, such an intestinal expression, Tomás thought, and an excellent back door into Portuguese Brazil and its ravenous hunger for slave labor. And so the slaves came in their thousands. "This pocket jingles with dazed African souls," Father Ulysses comments. That he traveled to Sao Tome on a slave ship was not incidental. He had applied to be a slave priest, a priest assigned to the salvation of the souls of slaves. "I want to serve the humblest of the humble, those whose souls man has forgot, but God hasn't." He explains his urgent new mission on Sao Tome. "A century and a half ago, some Hebraic children in ages from 2 to 8 years were brought to the island. From these noxious seeds, a wretched plant grew that spread its poison to all the soil, polluting the unwary. My mission is twice, then, once more to bring the African soul to God, and further to tear away from that soul the foul grappling roots of the Jew. I spend my days at the port, a sentinel of the Lord, waiting for slave ships to bring in their bounty. When one arrives, I board it and christen the Africans and read the Bible to them. 'You are all God's children,' I repeat to them tirelessly. I also draw the odd sketch." That is his duty, which he fulfills with unquestioning diligence, to welcome strangers to a faith they do not follow, in a language they do not understand. At this stage in his diary, Father Ulysses appears to be a churchman typical of his time, steeped in the Lord, steeped in ignorance and contempt. That will change, Tomás knows. He falls asleep in an unsettled frame of mind. He cannot find comfort in the automobile, neither in driving it nor in sleeping in it. In the morning he would like to wash, but neither soap nor towel is to be found in the cabin. After the usual motoring difficulties, he sets off. The road through a dull, flat landscape of tilled fields leads him to Porto Alto, which is a larger town than he expected. His skill in getting the automobile going has improved, but whatever composure this new ability gives him is seriously undermined by the surge of people who appear on all sides. People wave, people shout, people come close. A young man runs alongside the automobile.
"Hello!" he shouts. "Hello!" Tomas shouts back. "What an incredible machine!"
"Thank you."
"Won't you stop?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"I still have far to go,"
Tomas shouts. The young man moves off. Another young man appears right away in his stead, eager to pursue his own hollered dialogue with Tomas. As he gives up, he is replaced by another. All the way through Porto Alto, Tomas is kept in constant, shouting conversation with eager strangers jogging next to the machine. When at last he reaches the far edge of the town, he would like to cry out in victory at having so adroitly controlled the machine, but his voice is too hoarse. In the open country, he eyes the change speed lever. He has covered ground in the last 3 days. The machine has undeniable stamina, but so do snails. The manual is clear on the point, and his uncle proved it in practice in Lisbon. Real motoring results are to be achieved only in a higher gear. He rehearses in his mind. Finally, it comes down to doing it or not. Pedals, buttons, levers, these are released or pressed, pushed or pulled, each according to its need. He performs all these actions without taking his eyes off the road or letting air out of his lungs. The clutch pedal tingles, it seems, as if to signal to him that it has done its job and would be happy if he took his foot off its back, which he does. At the same moment, the accelerator pedal seems to fall forward ever so slightly, as if it, on the contrary, were hungry for the pressure of his foot. He pushes down harder. The monster pounces forward in second gear. The road is disappearing under its wheels with such thunder that he feels it's no longer the machine that is moving forward on the landscape, but the landscape that is being pulled from underneath it, like that hazardous trick in which a tablecloth is yanked off a fully set table. The landscape vanishes with the same menacing understanding that the trick will work only if done at lightning speed. Whereas earlier he was afraid of going too fast, now he's afraid of going too slowly, because if second gear malfunctions, it won't be just he who meets his end, smashing into a telegraph pole, but the entire porcelain landscape that will crash with him. In this madness, he is a teacup rattling on a saucer, his eyes glinting like bone china glaze. As he careers through space, motionless while in headlong motion, furiously staring ahead, he yearns for still, thoughtful landscapes, a calm vineyard like he saw yesterday, or a shoreline like Father Ulysses frequents, where each small wave lands upon his feet in prayerful collapse, like a pilgrim who has reached his destination. But the priest is jarred in his own way, is he not? As Tomas is shaking now in this infernal machine, so must Father Ulysses' hand shake at times as he commits his harrowed thoughts to the pages of his diary. The priest quickly becomes disenchanted with São Tomé. He gets along no better with the natural world there than he did in Angola. There is the same strangle of vegetation, fed by the same incessant showers and coddled by the same unremitting heat. He is afflicted by the wet season with its torrents of rain interspersed with gaps of stifling moist heat, and he is afflicted by the dry season with its burning heat and ground-level clouds of dripping mist. He complains bitterly of this hothouse weather that makes a green leaf sing and a man die. And then there are the supplementary, incidental miseries, the stench of a sugar mill, bad food, infestations of ants,
ticks as large as cherry pips, a cut to his left thumb that becomes infected. He speaks of a mulatto silence, a miscegenation between the heat and humidity of the island and the unhappy people on it. This mulatto silence creeps into all the senses. The slaves are sullen, have to be pushed to do anything, which they do in silence. As for the Europeans who live out their lives on Sao Tome, their words, usually curt and annoyed, are spoken, perhaps are heard, less likely are obeyed promptly, then are muffled by the silence. Work for the slaves on the plantations carries on from sunrise to sunset, with no singing or even conversation, with a one-hour break at noon to eat, rest, and become further aware of the silence. The working day ends with a speechless meal, solitude, and restless sleep. The nights are louder than the days on Sao Tome because of the lively insects. Then the sun rises and it all starts over in silence. Nourishing this silence are two emotions, despair and rage. Or, as Father Ulysses puts it, the black pit and the red fire. How well Tomas knows that pair. His relations with the island clergy become fraught with tension. He never gives the precise nature of his grievances. Whatever the cause, the result is clear. He becomes increasingly cut off from everyone. As his diary progresses, there are fewer and fewer mentions of interactions with fellow Europeans. Who else is there? The barriers of social status, language, and culture preclude any amicable dealings between a white man, even a priest, and slaves. Slaves come and go, communicating with Europeans mostly with their wide-open eyes. As for the locals, freed slaves and mulattoes, what they have to gain from Europeans is precarious. To trade with them, to work for them, to leave their sight, that is the best policy. Father Ulysses laments, "The shacks of natives disappear overnight, and rings of emptiness form around isolated white men, and I am that. I am an isolated white man in Africa." Tomas stops the machine and decides, after poking his face up at the sky, that the afternoon has turned cool and cloudy, unsuited to further motoring. Better to settle down for the day under the mink coat. The next day the road continues nearly villagelessly until Cuso, where there is a bridge across the river Soraya. Under the narrow bridge, alarmed egrets and herons, until then peaceably standing in the water, flutter away. He is pleased to see orange trees, the only splash of color in an otherwise gray day. He wishes the sun would come out. It's the sun that makes a landscape, drawing out its color, defining its contours, giving it its spirit. On the outskirts of a town named Ponte de Sor, he halts the automobile. He sets out on foot for the town. It's good to walk. He kicks his feet back vigorously. He's practically skipping backwards. But what is this itch that is bothering him? He scratches his scalp, his face, and his chest. It is his body crying to be washed. His armpits are starting to smell, as are his nether regions. He enters the town. People stare at him, at his manner of walking. He finds an apothecary to buy moto naphtha, following his uncle's advice of resupplying himself as often as he can. He asks the man at the counter if he has the product. He has to use a few names before the implacably serious man nods and produces from a shelf a small glass bottle, barely half a liter. "Do you have any more?" Tomas asks. The apothecary turns and brings down another two bottles.
"I'll have still more, please." "I don't have any more. That's my whole stock."
Tomas is disheartened. At this rate, he will have to ransack every apothecary between Ponte de Sor and the high mountains of Portugal.
"I'll take these three bottles, then," he says.
The apothecary brings them to the till. The transaction is routine, but something in the man's manner is odd. He wraps the bottles in a sheet of newspaper. Then, when two people enter the shop, he hastily slides the package over to him. Tomas notices that the man is staring at him fixedly. Self-consciousness overcomes him. He scratches the side of his head.
"Is something wrong?" he asks.
"No, nothing," replies the apothecary.
Tomas is bewildered, but says nothing. He leaves the shop and takes a walk around the town, memorizing the route he will take with the automobile. When he returns to Ponte de Sor an hour later,